Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 64 of Underserved. Today in studio, I have with me Amer Khan, Executive Director of Engineering at Athena Health. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Amer, thank you so much for coming down and joining us today to record Underserved.
Awesome. No, thank you for having me. This is a very exciting opportunity here. I was looking at your podcast in the background and seeing how you're really capitalizing on learning from the big software and tech leaders that are not in the startups. This is fantastic. So a big space that I'm passionate about.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. We have a whole bunch of different folks in the audience, from your peers in the software industry to young folks just getting into it. And I think that some of the stories and experiences make it more real and feel attainable for those folks. So we appreciate having you on. So one day long ago, you were like them. What were you doing as a young kid that got you interested in technology?
I was kind of always tinkering with hardware, software, randomly as I was growing up. I was always fixing stuff in the house, things of that capacity. However, when I went to college, I decided I should do engineering. Four of my friends were in computer science courses, and they all failed. And so I decided one time to just try it, and I got a D. And that kind of triggered me, and I was thinking, this logical math stuff is interesting. So I dropped out of engineering and switched 100% to computer science. So yeah, I mean, I dove right in. It was a lot of hours, a lot of nights, weekends, but I just wanted to learn it.
Well, that definitely takes some guts that four of your friends fail out of it. You go in, you get a D. I mean, D's get degrees, but still.
Yes, it was probably not the right career path for most people at that, but I was passionate. It was different. I think I was coasting through the normal engineering courses, physics and all those things. And I wanted something different. And the mathematical logic behind this and kind of how it relates to every single thing in the world was really fascinating.
Now, where were you at university then?
So I was at Northeastern, and I started there. When I switched to computer science, I transferred over to UMass Boston. I crammed it all. I squeezed it out, the CS degree, in 4 years. With a year left, I decided, okay, what should I do now? I didn't want to graduate. So I went to UMass Amherst, did some research in AI for a year. I had PhD ambitions at the time, but at the end of that research, I decided not to pursue PhD stuff. So decided to try to come back and work.
Well, I'm glad you sobered up. Now, you almost switched majors again, right? Well, you were at UMass Boston?
Yes. So I took what was a 60s US history course with Professor Atwood, and it was the most mind-blowing course I had taken. And it's just that such a strong era of time after World War II. And after that, I took three or four more, and I decided I'm going to switch to history. And I filled out the paperwork. I had to walk to his office and ask for a transfer. And he looked at me and said, "So you do computer stuff?" I said, "Yes." And he ripped it up in front of me and he threw it away. And he said, "Do your computer stuff, read history on the weekends." And I was devastated. My parents were so excited. So, but honestly, some of the best advice ever. So I'm very obsessed with history still. A lot of reading, a lot of documentaries. And yeah, history is still very fascinating, but it's a good hobby to have.
So you graduate. Where do you end up going to work first?
My first job was for a healthcare company, actually, Meditech. Mm-hmm. So Meditech was really big on entry-level engineers. At the time, it's the same, you know, predicament most people get into. Oh, I don't have experience. Oh, you need 1 to 2 years experience. Meditech happened to be proactive on taking folks at the entry level. So I worked there for almost 6 months. I decided that I would just take my job very seriously, and that's what I did. And I learned a lot about interfaces and Meditech interfaces to other software and hardware pieces. And then I decided to go back to grad school.
Now, your title there, though, was interesting. Programmer of non-magic interfaces.
Exactly. So Magic is, I believe, an offshoot of MUMPS. And MUMPS is a programming language, I believe, was from the 80s timeframe. And the CEO of that company wrote the entire application himself with that language. But then he offshooted it and called it Magic. So the first couple months, you weren't allowed to actually touch code. You had to be in training, learning how to code in their language.
Oh, man, talk about your proprietary forks.
Exactly.
Wow. All right. So after several months, you're like, all right, enough of this. I'm going back to grad school. So you go back to Northeastern?
I went back to Northeastern. I decided to pursue computer systems engineering, which was a concentration with software architecture type of background. I worked with the Professor Morant. He was big on computer vision had a whole 3D thing going with tons of graphic software and things of that nature. So it was good. After a little bit, I decided to apply for a co-op. So the advisors at Northeastern are very well connected. My advisor made some phone calls. A day later, he gave me an offer. 2 days later, I was flying to Seattle and living there for the next 6 months.
Wow. Where was your co-op in Seattle?
My co-op was for Intel. So it was in a town called DuPont in Washington.
Okay.
So yeah, it was really cool. It was working for Intel. I never had worked at a company at that capacity before, you know, several hundred thousand employees, just even attending the company meetings and seeing all the presentations and the executives. And it was a great experience. I learned a lot about VBC. Visual Basic 6, VisualBasic.net, playing with their server software. I was one of the interns working on the server management software.
Any notable stories while you were there?
I think the big notable story was one time we all got called like 4 a.m. And so we had a small data center that we were running, and all the alarms were going off. So we all had to go to work, and you get there and it's 200 degrees inside the data center room, and things had melted. The AC had given out. So,
oh, wow.
So I did not have the pleasure of going in. And after I heard about the temperature, I decided to stay back, let the hardware guys take care of it.
That's a good idea. So what made you decide to wind that up? Did you want to be back in the Boston area?
So I was looking at opportunities in Intel and Seattle. Amazon had big pushes there too. And the rain bothered me. Seattle is full of rain. It rains every single day.
The stereotype is true.
Even if it rains for 5 minutes, it will rain. It must rain. So kind of wanted to come back here. I had reached out to some friends. One of my friends worked at Raytheon, put in good word. And yeah, that's it. Then I decided to come back here and take the job at Raytheon.
So you figure maybe it's a short-term thing. How long do you end up staying there?
Frankly speaking, I didn't plan on working in DoD. I was thinking, okay, I'll try this for 4 to 6 months, transition out to a different company. Fast forward 9.5 years, and you know, I was there almost a decade.
Wow. Now, when we talked on the pre-call, you mentioned you were obsessed with the monolith. And all I could think of was, have you seen the movie 2001?
Of course, yes. Yes. So Raytheon was the first time I got exposure to a real monolith. So Meditech, I guess, was kind of a monolith as well, but Raytheon, it was the first time I got to see it holistically. The code base I was working on was from 1948.
Say that again. What year?
1948.
Wow.
I didn't even know they're writing code back then.
What language?
The language is a predecessor to Ada. So it's called Jovial. So Ada, I think, was popular in the 70s.
Wow.
And then take a 500 million lines of code, 50 years of software development on it that does tons of stuff, and now you have to work on that.
That's a spaghetti factory.
That's the nicest thing you could say about it. Yeah, it was very awesome because I resisted hard initially. And after some coaching from my mentor, he told me, hey, look, we have this thing. If we want to retire it or get rid of it, let's dive in, learn it inside out. And so that's what I did. I focused hard and tried to learn the monolith.
You have to know the monolith to destroy the monolith.
Exactly. I like to say retiring the monolith is kind of my catchphrase. Like, let's get together, let's retire the monolith wherever we are. And that planted the seeds for my career, where I tend to target companies where there is a monolith to retire.
So were you emulating things at all at any point during this?
Oh, of course. So my mentor had this great idea that let's write an emulator. And then they had all sorts of discussions about, oh, this was funded in the 90s. The project did not work. It'll never work. It took about a couple of years, kind of off the side of the desk project. And yeah, we could not get it to work either until we found that there were some hardware bugs that meant we needed to introduce the hardware bugs into the software emulator.
Be bug for bug compatible.
Exactly. So the documentation in 1948 was wrong.
Now you had some other interesting hardware issues too, right?
Oh yes. Yep. That was the lead integrator on the software side for one of the projects. And we had this bug that would sporadically show up. And we probably spent around 14, 15 months investigating this with, and we could not figure it out until one of the principal fellows there kind of made the correlation that it has to do with weather. And I was like, what do you mean it has to do with weather? We write software. Like, that's nothing to do with weather. And long story short, he discovered that anytime that the maintenance person got cold, he was wearing a fleece. And when he walked by, he would just send a little bit of static in. Yeah, so unshielded cables in hardware are not a good thing.
So he walks by in his fleece jacket, and yep, a little static electric charge goes through, hits some unshielded cable, boom, bug.
Boom, that's it, bug. And it's such a tough bug. I probably spent at least 1,000 hours troubleshooting this thing.
Man.
So it was quite fun, quite fascinating. I learned a lot and became friends with a lot of people.
Wow, I don't doubt it. I mean, those ones that, like, it's just not straightforward to reproduce, or it goes away on its own.
Exactly.
Like, that's definitely coming back on its own.
That's the fun part about working in that space is, you know, the missile defense area. You will get data that says, hey, there's this bug, and you can run it through your algorithm 100 times and you'll never be able to reproduce it.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, you mentioned missile defense. I think you did some work for missile defense in the Middle East.
Yep. So the big contract we worked on was the UAE system integration for the Patriot missile system. There is a fascinating story about how the contract was procured because the salesman went to Abu Dhabi and it took him about 16, 17 years to land the contract. And, you know, it was almost a $4 billion contract. So it makes sense.
16 to 17 year sales cycle.
That's incredible.
Raytheon's paying this guy's base salary. Like, come on, buddy.
I imagine he also gets a good chunk of that money.
That's a heck of a commission.
That's going to be a strong commission there for certain. So given that, what I found out through him was that he went to do the sale, pitched the royal family again. The royal family member came with their entourage, and the U.S. side had their entourage of generals and all their friends and a whole military base. And he got out of the car, whispered something to the lead person, walks over.
This is like the prince or something?
Yeah, the royal prince.
Okay.
Yep. And he walks over, says something, says, hey, find me the lowest ranking officer in this base. You hear that all these folks are scrambling. They find a private first class 18-year-old. And he kind of grabs him, takes him away from the group, talks to him for 5-10 minutes, walks back, gets in the car and leaves, signs it the next day. So it's like a movie, literally.
Yeah, it sounds like a scene out of a movie. So what was the exchange between the royal prince and the private?
So we heard later, you know, hey, Ports, everyone's grilling him. What did he say? What did he say? And he asked him, you know, what's the toughest part of your job with this Patriot system? And he said that the toughest part is the cables. They're just really heavy to move around. So some background, they had been investigating other options with other countries, and there were software defects and hardware defects that were causing issues. So the prince hearing that it's only the heaviness of the cables was, okay, cool, let's sign this thing.
Huh. So it's a pain to drag around the heavy cables for it, but it works.
But it works, yep. And that's what he wanted to hear.
Here's $4.5 billion. Let's let it rip.
Exactly. Yep.
Wow. Well, I guess that's a lesson that you got to make sure things are working and know that right down to the private first class.
Literally, yep. Everybody's important.
Everybody's on board. Now, I think while you were there, you did a stint as a diversity champion as well.
I did. So I kind of volunteered for it and it happened accidentally. I actually just didn't have awareness of diversity and inclusion prior to this. So I give a resume, then they hire my friend. Then I give another resume. I probably submitted 50 plus resumes of close friends, and over 12 got hired. One time the HR folks told me, like, hey, look, you know, we have diversity goals and, you know, you happen to be of Middle Eastern descent. And if you have any more friends, keep sending them. And I didn't realize at the time that Raytheon was a certain diversity and they were trying to be inclusive and look at all backgrounds. So I started working on that through my Abu Dhabi friend. I heard about one of the mishaps at the royal family member's house. So apparently the prince had offered him tea and he was a salesman and he had said no. And he offered it again and he still said no. And for a Middle Eastern culture person, when you offer something, you take it. If you don't, it's considered rude. So the prince was offended.
So you take the tea. You don't have to drink the tea.
You don't have to drink it, but you must. So I can't remember how many sessions I did where I'm like, just take the tea. Don't drink it. It's fine. Just say yes, thank you so much. Pretend to sip it. Just anything. Just be courteous and just accept whatever they give you.
So what else did Raytheon do to implement diversity and inclusion?
Oh, Raytheon was super supportive. So they allowed me to set up a prayer room. And then we got to have prayer times for people. When the Middle East delegation would come, they'd call me and I could at least help set up more things for them to cater to their cultural needs. It's just that awareness and that discussion amongst everyone was just so heartwarming and nice to see. I just didn't imagine in corporate America that was a thing.
When a lot of people picture Raytheon, they picture like these crusty old dudes that have been there forever. How were they receiving this and understanding diversity and inclusion?
Oh, they loved it. And when they started to see the awareness, started to see the business expansion, started seeing people internal that were leading these groups, and it all kind of started to blend together.
That's good. What makes you realize, like, okay, I may not want to stay here forever?
After that big project ship, I did some soul searching. I spoke to my director, who managed a couple thousand people at the time, and he told me, hey, your next opportunity might be down the hallway or down the highway. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? And that's what he meant. Find your next opportunity. And maybe it's here, maybe it's not. I was a big believer in the Patriot family. It's a very family dynamic, a very crazy family dynamic, but we were a family. You felt really good working on that project with your friends. So I applied for a couple jobs and then I shipped off.
And where'd you end up?
I ended up at a company called Taxware.
I imagine it's tax software.
Yep. They're not H&R Block. That's the first thing.
Okay.
So their software plugs into big ERPs and essentially do the tax calculations. Tax calculations seem straightforward. However, by so many variations, there's millions of differences, and the tax codes are constantly changing.
So it's like sales tax by county, like exactly. New York City. I know there's a city tax.
Exactly.
Figuring out that whole mess.
Exactly that mess. And then the corporate side. So the person there that I went to work for was Matt Barkham, a really good guy, really agile person. He really drove home the process around happiness and engagement at work. That's when I really started to get involved with it. And then also I learned a lot about Agile and how to move teams using Agile methodologies.
Did you learn any lessons about product management?
Oh, of course. At Raytheon, I took product management for granted. At this company, I had to work on a project. We decided to work hard, 6 months, get it out. A year later, sold none. And I asked the VP of product, you know, what happened? Why did we do this if there's no sales? And he said, and so I asked him to see the data. And he said, you know, I heard about this project through a gentleman at the conference in the hallway, and I decided to take a bet on it. And I was like, oh my God, did I just bet my team's career on this?
Yeah, you got to understand there's got to be some sort of data or indication of need behind it and not just desirements.
Oh, 100%. I think that product manager was unique and probably just trusted a hunch. So usually product managements are much more diligent.
After you leave Taxware, where do you end up?
So after Taxware, I had another friend. So I went to a company called Skyhook Wireless, which was a small company. It was really interesting because when I first joined, all the engineers were just doing stuff and no one knew what they were actually working on. Smaller company, but really interesting space because they basically patent the Wi-Fi triangulation via GPS. So like you could figure out based on a Wi-Fi scan where you would sit, and you could locate someone through their device.
So like down to what level of resolution? Probably a foot, right?
It's very specific. It's to the point where it tied into ad tech. So you could literally be walking by a coffee shop and by a Wi-Fi scan, they could send you an ad for the coffee.
So we actually did a project like that here for a customer. You'd have at least 3 Wi-Fi beacons within a store, and we would figure out down to a foot where you were. And if you were in front of the Captain Crunch, we'd push you a Captain Crunch coupon.
Yep. So they happened to get in on one of the earliest iPhones. And since they got in through the iPhone app or through the iPhone iOS, that's when they were able to build their giant database. Then they also went to Android. Then long story short, in the future at some point, Google built their own, Apple built their own.
Oh, so they home grew a database of, hey, this Wi-Fi beacon sits exactly at these coordinates?
Something like that. And then tied it to a GPS coordinate. Exactly. But based on the severity of the scan, so they're using some fancy magic that obviously the PhD folks there knew how to do.
And who were the heads of the company there?
At the time, there was a gentleman named Farshid. He was the chief scientist, and they're the ones with the patents.
And what was the level of organization on the dev team there?
Yes. So to start, it was very slim, ultimately turned into teams. I did a fun exercise in Agile. I said, you know what? No one knows what everyone's working on. We're missing that collaboration. Let's just do a stand-up in the morning. 30 people. Let's go. And it was met with some resistance, of course, but part of change management, you meet resistance and you keep persevering. And it got pretty productive at some point. Obviously, we split to a much more normal level, but it was quite the fun exercise to just show up at a company and be like, okay, everyone in the morning, tell me what you're working on.
What's the tech stack like there?
Skyhook was a big data house. So it started with Hadoop, but then we hired a bunch of folks to move the whole stack to Spark.
And from a business perspective, do they end up getting in a fist fight with any of the big players?
They did. They had a huge fight with Google, and they basically filed a patent infringement lawsuit against Google, you know, a decade or so ago. And you learn a little bit about Google's strategy and how they deal with smaller players in their space. And so they ended up settling at the time, which was the biggest settlement in patent infringement history in tech at the time. So after the settlement, that's kind of when things started to change. Started getting absorbed by a different company. That's when I started looking for my next opportunity.
And where do you end up working after that?
So in the same building and meeting with a person from Bullhorn, and they sold me on it. It seemed they were part of the equity firm package under Vista, which owned Taxware and then owned Bullhorn as well. So I decided to take the plunge and try it out.
So the importance of staying friendly with folks in your network ends up paying off.
Yes. I mean, they say that you should always rely on your network and keep expanding your network. And, you know, if you play your cards right, you'll never really have to look for a job. People will find you.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Now, was there a monolith here for you to attack?
Big monolith here as well. So there was a project called Nova that was to move that monolith over. So the stack was very heavy on Cold Fusion with the goal to move to Java microservices and Angular too. So we had a front-end team, back-end team. I learned a lot about NPS score through Bullhorn. That was fascinating. They had one of the highest NPS scores in their industry and they kept it.
For people that don't know, what is an NPS score?
Sure. Net Promoter Score. You know, they build recruiting software and they do client surveys and all sorts of stuff to figure out what their score is. And that score kind of indicates to the company how well you're doing against your peers. With their score so high, they had an interesting perspective on UX design. So if you were changing anything on UX, you would have a meeting. The CTO would be present. All the super leaders, the directors would be there. And everyone would look at the UX. It was a really cool culture to see that front end experience.
A lot of wireframes and mock-ups.
A lot of discussions. They expected everybody to be able to navigate the app and know what that looks like.
Did you test this out on like a subset of users before you would start implementing?
Of course. They would do user testing, market research, user research, all sorts of A-B testing. There was tons of it.
Now, Nova is Spanish for no go. But you do end up going on from there to Athena Health, right?
Yep. So Athena was an interesting one because after some time, I decided to explore and see what else is out there. Athena was my practice interview for Google offshoots. That was in Boston. And so I was like, okay, I'll take this interview, see what happens. So I go for the interview. I'd heard of Athena, but I didn't know much about them. So I just knew that they were in Boston and in healthcare. I go for the interview and really this one gentleman sold me hard. He was just so passionate about technology. His technical background was really strong. His name was David Chang. I was like, wow, I think I need to work with this guy.
Were you tempted at all to maybe go back to Raytheon? Don't they have some sort of like, you know, your job's still here for you, buddy?
Of course. So I kept in touch with my Raytheon folks. They have a thing where you leave the company within 5 years. If you return as a boomerang, you essentially get to retain your status. So that was my last straw. Like, do I go back or do I move to Athena? So after doing some soul searching, some homework, I decided, you know what, I think I'm learning a lot in these new spaces. I'm going to continue to expand. So
David Chang gets you in the door. Does he sell you a monolith?
He sells me on the monolith. So the second he said monolith, I said, oh my God, please sign me up. He mentions like a couple hundred thousand or a couple million lines of Perl on the back end. And I was like, oh, that sounds fascinating. I did not know Perl could get that large. And then I was like, I need to understand this a little bit more.
It will if you let it.
Yeah, apparently. So he undersold it. It was much bigger than that.
Are they making heavy use of like the CPAN modules or is it everything like rolled from scratch or?
It was from scratch. And then when modern architecture started coming out with, hey, build a REST layer, build this layer, the engineers there decided, you know what, we'll just do it in Perl.
Wow.
So it speaks to really the level of intelligence because as a result, the monolith is not a normal monolith. It's a very complex monolith. So they hired some of the top talent in the industry for it. And the engineers, I've never seen such strong engineers in my career.
So Perl's the back end. Are you guys JavaScript on the front end?
JavaScript front end using some portion of Backbone. And that's kind of the starter set. That's where most of the code base lives. You know, at the time they hired Prakash from Salesforce and he was the CTO and he had a whole plan on let's migrate this, let's move it, let's retire this thing. So I got a little excited and I said, okay, let's dive in. Let's go.
All right. So you start trying to learn the monolith so that you can kill the monolith.
Exactly.
And how does that go?
So there are always road bumps on the way to retiring a monolith. So we decided to carve off a portion of the front end and really use React and just try to get a portion of React into the JavaScript lane and see what happens. So part of my research when I first joined a company is I try to ask the engineers of all levels, you know, hey, what's your biggest problem at work? And the biggest problems that I found at this company was one was the managers were changing too often. So they were on a release cycle and they would change managers as a result. And then the other one was lack of access to new technology for the folks working on the legacy stack. So why not blend it all together?
So I had never heard the term that you told me about on the pre-call, a steel thread.
So a steel thread is something that connects every piece of software or hardware across the board. So I really push for steel threads. I'm a big believer that if you have a theory, try it. My engineers would say, hey, I want to put React in. And then I remember the question I asked him. I said, so why didn't you do it? And he said, I don't know. I just didn't know I should. I was like, well, if you think it can happen, just do it. So SteelThread in the hardware software land was very specific, where you could actually run a piece of software on every piece of hardware, or even network connectivity, SteelThread, or different devices in the cloud. SteelThread is my first line of attack. And then really, it's a lot of agile methodology taking home. So where you're iterating, you know, so your SteelThread will help you fail fast, then you iterate, then you fail fast, iterate, and then you keep going.
So this might manifest itself if you have a working web application, you want to introduce React, you put one little tiny control in there and then hook that up to the backend and then make sure it's actually saved to the database and you deploy it as well. And now that you can see this one thing working end to end, you can start expanding it.
Exactly. Yep. You captured it perfectly, because what happens with these monoliths is no one knows the intricacies of the monolith anymore. It's too big. And some of the original coders or designers have left the company. So now what do you do? So instead of investing heavy in the new stack, you want to invest slowly and start to iterate. So it's really taking that agile methodology home. And it's such a big risk mitigation, because then your project, you know, will work. The other thing you find is in production, the setup is very different for all these companies. The staging environments, the dev environments do one thing and then they go to production and then nothing works. And all the monoliths that I worked on that quote unquote retired, portions of the monolith live forever because no one could figure them out. They were too complex or some other reason. I can pick on Athena for one. Like, there will be portions of the monolith that are just very effective and efficient working with the Oracle database, and those may never retire, and that's okay. It just means we're limiting investment in the future.
If it's up and it's stable, it's always hard to make the case like, yeah, let's rewrite it.
Exactly.
If it's not really changing.
Exactly.
You know, if the business needs are not forcing code changes, then it's very hard to say, let's rewrite it for the sake of rewriting.
Yep. So that's why for me, when I'm working on a monolith, I really tie it to a product management deliverable. So as long as I'm tying business value, then the product management team is excited. And then they're seeing a stronger feature delivery and more efficiently and more effectively. Then you're seeing engineers engaged, and then engineers are happy. And if everybody's happy, everybody's winning.
So you guys are growing rapidly. You must be hiring.
Yep. Andrew, the last 3 years at Athena have been tremendous growth. It's in the news now. We're in acquisition, end of Q1, they're saying. We're also going to be hiring a ton. I work with some of the strongest engineers in the industry. It's in healthcare. We're making changes, you know, in software that millions plus providers are using every day. It's a really awesome opportunity to tie tech to business, and I'm hiring a ton. So if you are interested in listening, please contact me. You can find me on LinkedIn or through Andrew, and I'd be happy to move forward here.
And we'll be sure to include Amer's LinkedIn profile in the show notes. So if you're listening, just go to the Underserved website. That's underserved.fm. And you'll see the show notes for episode 64 to get in touch. So when you're not working, what are you doing for fun?
So I have two girls. They're 10 and 12 years old. I wanted them to be as excited about Marvel as I am. So I watched all 29 Marvel movies with them in chronological order. So that was awesome. A lot of fun. That's one part. I fostered a lot of dogs last year. I worked with Last Hope Canine. I fostered over 18 dogs. I actually just got a dog last week. So my forever dog.
Oh, so you would foster them and kind of raise them at your house until someone adopted them more permanently?
Exactly. Last Hope Canine works with the shelters in Alabama, and then they take the extra dogs that they can't support there, send them up here, and then they get adopted here. So a lot of like learning different dog styles and, you know, how to help them decompress and get confident again, and then they go to good homes.
Tell me about the dog you have now then.
So my current dog is Boinga. She's a husky mix. She's 3 years old, so she just got here, I guess, a couple weeks ago. So far, so good. So far, so pleasant. She's just sitting at home right now, relaxing, waiting for me to come back.
What's the funniest thing Boinga does?
So she has the husky mix. So if you're preparing her food, she'll just start howling, chasing you like, hurry up, give me my food, please.
We have an English Golden Retriever that we got like at the tail end of the pandemic. We had had a couple before him, but he has these little quirks that are so strange, like where he'll lie on his back and use his paws to hold his toy up in the air and then gnaw at it while it's up in the air.
I love it. I love that every dog is so unique. They're little people, right? Like even Boinga, she will not sleep in my bed. She'll sleep next to it. But then she'll look at me and she'll put her paw on my face, which means pet me now. Like.
Good luck stopping.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you tried to get your daughters interested in coding at all?
Oh, yeah, of course. My friends and I, we've worked with my daughters for a couple of years now, doing random coding projects, exposing the technology, even building little microchips, things like that. So just trying to explore that. They do participate in a thing called Russian Math, which is an after-school program that teaches you the concepts of math. As a result, their math is extremely strong compared to mine. But yeah, this year especially, we have a couple boot camps coming up for that. We want to kind of explore that that software side and see what they can do.
And then you had another hobby, kind of figuring out what causes virality.
Oh, yes. That's a big thing. I didn't even know it was a hobby until you talked to me about it. So anything that goes viral, I realize I just get fascinated by it. I have to study it. I have to figure out what's happening. I guess it's because I'm a people person. I'm also a leader at work, so it helps me with work. I have kids, helps me with my kids, helps me with my family, and kind of just ties it all together. So, for example, I'll use Game of Thrones. So I was always a believer that anything going viral means I should ignore it. I'm not a viral person. But with Game of Thrones, I did the same thing for 5 years and just ignored it. And then one day I got stuck in St. Louis for work. It was snowing in Boston and I had delayed flights. And I watched, I think, 5 seasons in 6.5 days or something like that. And I was like, oh, this is why people like it. So, and then I realized I could relate to a lot of people. One of the companies I worked for, Pokemon Go, became popular. And Pokemon was after my time growing up. So I never really got into it. And so I ignored it until I realized every single engineer I had was playing it. So then I downloaded it and I started it. Then I was driving around with my friends, picking up Pokemon in Somerville and all these things. And then one day the highlight was, you know, the HR person we were working with messaged the Pokemon group, said, hey, there's a Snorlax in Boston Common. And you saw like 25 people in the office get up and run. It's 100 degrees outside. Sweating to death, just running to get the Snorlax before he disappears. And we couldn't find it. And then you see on the corner, like, I don't know, 20, 25 gentlemen with suits on, bankers, and they're all playing on their phone. And obviously that's where it is. I probably spoke to more people in those 3 months in Boston than I have in my entire life as a person that was born and raised here. Pokemon Go like crossed every boundary and you became social with everyone.
When you talk about the virality and being unable to avoid Game of Thrones, my friend Mike couldn't invest the time. He didn't get stuck in St. Louis, but he wanted to be conversant in it because he was going on dates and all the women he was going out with knew about Game of Thrones. So he started obsessively reading like all the Wikipedia entries so he could be conversant in it, like Cliff Notes, without having to actually watch the series.
It's such a fascinating story too. It's fascinating that it became so viral.
Did you see the thing where one of the crew accidentally left a Starbucks cup in one of the scenes?
I did. I've seen a lot of those scenes. I mean, I ended up watching it because my wife at the time made me watch it again with her. Then my other friends were like, we need to watch it with you. So I ended up watching it 3 times.
That takes some doing.
Yep. I have a lot of engineering friends, and especially that are much more connected to the culture than I am. Some of my engineers at work, like William Kim, Asim Shamim, these guys connect me to all the modern things. So one thing was when the pandemic struck, they were like, you got to learn first-person shooter games. And I was a gamer growing up. I just gave up gaming a long time ago. So I went, bought a PlayStation, got the monitor, got the controllers, started playing. And that was my pandemic goal, to become proficient in an FPS game.
And which one did you become proficient in?
Warzone. So okay. I probably played every night till like 4 a.m. with these guys. and then I'd do my work meetings in the morning. And then I'd randomly take a nap and then randomly back to work. And then it was so fun. Again, another viral thing, right? Millions of people playing it. And why, right? It's actually a really good precursor to the metaverse, because my college friends, my high school friends, they're all playing as well. And then you're in these chats, and then you're meeting in this virtual world and running around and taking helicopters. And it really sold me on even the metaverse concept of what that's going to look like in the future.
In some ways, it seems like a grand, amazing idea. In some ways, it seems like Second Life.
Exactly.
Like we've seen this before.
We have. Yep. Yep. My kids are obsessed with Roblox. They play constantly. I don't know how much money I've spent on it.
Yeah.
Like, and they love it. And it's a whole virtual world. They're solving these complex problems. They're doing all these complex things with friends of theirs that, you know, due to pandemic, haven't been able to really meet.
My youngest daughter during the pandemic took up Fortnite with all of her classmates, and they would get on there with the headsets and trash talk each other. And she got pretty good at it. And I would kind of creep on it to figure out like, well, how does this work? What's going on? I tried playing a little bit, got roasted.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. Same. I got roasted so bad, but I've had some good friends teaching me, and obviously you got to put in hours, and yeah, it's been quite the experience. I mean, I was able to literally recruit an engineer for my org through Call of Duty.
Wow.
So Call of Duty has all sorts of positive impact right now. So,
and it sounds like it counts as work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Lunch break. You know, I remember in the office, we used to play Smash Brothers at lunch break, you know, or something else. So video games have a very interesting correlation to kind of the engineering mindset, being able to reset your mind. I'm big on breaks. I read a study a long time ago that I guess I was probably 5 or 6 years in my career at the time. And I read the study that said the top 1% of performers, they were studying trends across them and were trying to figure out what helps them perform. And they didn't find too many commonalities because they looked across every industry, But the one thing they found was like every hour they were taking a 10-minute break, which was interesting. And I realized that I was doing that. Every hour I just get up and walk, go talk to my friend, go get some coffee. Apparently it has to do with the way your brain resets and then caches your short-term memory and all sorts of, science stuff that I can't understand fully. So I encourage breaks all the time.
Well, my watch keeps telling me to get up every hour, but I tend to be a jag person. Once I sit down and I get to the concentration and lock everything else out, like if I'm editing a podcast or a video or coding or something, like 3 hours will go by. I'll be like, oh my God, like I got to go somewhere. I got to get something to eat. Like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But you might be taking breaks mentally and you don't even know. You might be reading an article in the middle or texting a friend.
Or hitting alt tab and going to the browser.
Exactly. So there's many ways people take breaks.
Did you get pulled into the virality of Squid Game at all?
Of course. I was one of the first people to watch it. I was like, I need to watch this. And then it led me to so many other dark shows. It was really well done. I loved it.
It was very well done. I ended up being the game master for Halloween.
Yeah, I almost did. But my kids are a little too young, so I didn't want to get a Squid Game costume yet.
So, Amer, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, this was a pleasure. It was awesome meeting you and hearing about your team. And this was my first podcast, but I had a great time.
Well, you did great. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.